Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is our Friday Week in Review. So much tension in the news this week around resignations and firings, a battle in the state GOP over a state committee member's offensive remarks and who represents today's party.
How is that taking away your free speech? The minute you lose inclusive stuff, that's where you lose everything. That's the Marxist agenda.
That scene captured by NBC TV Boston outside the state party meeting Wednesday. The chair of the Boston Pride Board announces she'll step aside as Black, brown, and trans activist groups push for representation.
This is not just trans resistance. This is what the community overall wants. They know that we have not been invited to the table, which is why we created our own.
And Boston's acting mayor fires police commissioner Dennis White, and former Mayor Marty Walsh comes under fire for appointing him in the first place.
I was not aware of these incidents when I appointed Dennis White as commissioner of Boston. If I had known that, I would not have appointed him.
Meanwhile, two resignations from the Boston School Committee, including the chair. So let's start in Boston. The number to join our conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Our panelists this week, Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress, and Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and president of Isaacson Political Consulting. Richard, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
And Arlene, welcome back to you too.
Thanks so much. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you both. And I want to start with the two resignations by Latinx women on the Boston School Committee this week after texts they exchanged denigrating residents of West Roxbury surfaced. Listeners, the ask to you, were the resignations appropriate? There have now been three resignations for racial comments by school committee members in the last year. How does any board or committee in any town or city move forward from that? What are the next steps? And should school committees be appointed or elected? That's been one of the questions raised as a result of this crisis. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to share your thoughts. So, Arlene, what do you think is at the heart of the story here? What is this really about with the Boston School Committee?
Well, there's a couple of layers. On the one hand, I read the comments by the two women who recently resigned, and in which they explain that some of their comments were based on experiences they had when they were young, instances of discrimination, and hateful comments that were said to them by white folks in the city. And, you know, I think they make, on the one hand, a fair point that it's not simply comparable to take the victims of discrimination and the victims of hate and say it's the same thing when they cast aspersion on the perpetrators of that hate towards them. It's not the same thing. The power dynamic is quite different. But on the other hand, wrong is wrong, whether it's to them or by them, wrong is wrong. And as members of the school committee, they do need to set a good example for kids. So I admire them for having the wisdom to voluntarily step down from the position and make a statement about that in that way. On the other hand, so I think that school boards should be elected. I don't think they should be appointed. I think if we can trust people, the public to make to choose their own elected leaders on city councils and mayoral spots, we can trust them to make school committee appointments as well.
So let's pick up on that. Here's Ruby Reyes, the executive director of Boston Education Justice Alliance, a progressive advocacy group.
An elected versus an appointed school committee. A lot of times, you know, folks talk about hybrids in the essence of saying, you know, we don't want these interest groups to come in and like make decisions. But the reality is that it's happening with an appointed school committee.
So, Richard, how much of this is about structure? That this is an elected committee. I mean, there is a race dimension to everything that's happening, and we'll come back to the meeting where all of this happened in a minute. But does structure, does the fact that this is an appointed school committee affect this situation as well?
Well, I may be wrong, but I remember back in the day that this came before the legislature, and I've actually voted to allow or to change it to an appointed school committee. And at the time, the arguments were that you would get a higher caliber of people serving by taking the electoral process out of it and, you know, having the people appointed to the position by the mayor. So when I think this whole situation, though, makes, you know, me question the way I voted, if it was the right vote or not, because, I mean, you have, you know, a very contentious issue that came before the school committee. And, you know, three of the seven people who participated, you know, in this whole issue had to resign for making racist remarks. So clearly the caliber of people on the school committee, you know, if the change was to improve it, you know, the school committee is not looking too good right now.
And so to remind our listeners, in fact, Michael LeCanto, who was at the time of the meeting where these statements happened or text exchanges happened, also resigned shortly after the meeting. And the meeting was focused on this question of a temporary suspension of the exam entrance exam for the exam schools given the pandemic. And the committee, after a 9-hour meeting, did decide to suspend that entrance exam. Arlene, I want to play you a little more sound here. This is Ed Coppinger, the state rep for West Roxbury, who is saying that he wants further work on the exam school admissions question to be suspended while the remaining four members of the committee go under scrutiny.
They need to look at everyone's backgrounds, comments. Were they posting things on Facebook, Twitter, and things like that? Very similar to what folks would do in the private sector for job interviews. I mean, if people have preconceived ideas and not going into what's in the best interest of all students from every neighborhood, then they need to be reevaluated.
So, Arlene, I mentioned a minute ago I didn't want to take the question of race out of this. We know that the question of exam schools and the exam to get in has been racially fraught. We know that there were racial tensions around this meeting. Here is a representative from West Roxbury saying we can't even talk about this subject of exam schools until we do some reexamination. Is that right, or is this a time when you rebuild an institution but move forward with its policy work at the same time? What do you think?
I don't think it has to be longitudinal. I think there can be simultaneity here. I suspect I have a different opinion than the state rep on this issue, because I believe that the exam should be, in fact, revisited as an issue. But regardless of which side you're on, they can move forward with conversation about it. But I do agree that it is fair to look at what people post publicly on social media about different issues. I feel that way about the Boston Police Department. I feel that way about elected leaders and appointed leaders. We all have to be held accountable for the things that we post, even though sometimes it may feel unfair to do so.
So actually, I want to pick up that thread and I want to put the question out to listeners, you out there, 1-800-423-8255. To some extent, the whole conversation today, this whole week in review, is about accountability. It's about being held accountable for the things that you say and the things that you do. And when being removed from your position, whether it's a paid position or a voluntary position or an appointed position, is appropriate. We welcome your thoughts on that. What do you think? We've been talking about the Boston School Committee. We're going to go back to talking about Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White here and former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Share your thoughts on those broad questions. Again, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I think we will move now to this story that we've been following for quite a while now, which is this week, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey made good, for lack of a better phrase, on her stated intention to fire Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White. Richard, was that inevitable once the courts sort of let that hearing proceed?
Well, I think it was inevitable that, you know, I feel bad that she was handed the hot potato, but, you know, she pretty much from the very beginning pretty much telegraphed what she was going to do. And, you know, she acted as the judge, jury, and executioner. And, you know, I think that a lot of people looked at her as somebody who there was a pretty good chance that she would be in the final two, you know, after the primary. But I think this whole episode, you know, raises a lot of questions. And, you know, it's making people think about what type of mayor will she be. I mean, if you're a city employee or a resident of the city, and, you know, will you get a fair process? You know, if you did something 20 years ago or were accused of something 20 years ago, are you going to be fired from your job without, you know, the benefit of having any due process? And so it was a rash, you know, I think some people look at it as, you know, very political and a rash decision that she ended up making. And I think for the city, you know, it's there was no way that he could stay. But it, just the way it played out, I think, doesn't make the city look very good. And it's going to make it harder for whoever the next mayor is to really, you know, to really pick up the pieces and move the city forward.
So, Arlene, picking up on Richard's thread there, I'm going to play two pieces of sound for you here. First is Acting Mayor Kim Janey talking about the firing this week.
It is clear that Dennis White's return as commissioner would send a chilling message to victims of domestic violence in our city and reinforce a culture of fear and a blue wall of silence in our police department.
And now I'm going to play WBUR reporter Deborah Becker reading to us on Radio Boston a statement from White's lawyer, you know, basically right after it happened.
Quote, Commissioner White is deeply disappointed by Acting Mayor Janey's decision. Quote, he is a black man falsely accused of crimes, not given a fair trial or hearing, and then convicted or terminated, which is the equivalent here. This reflects an ugly pattern in our country. That's a statement from Dennis White's attorney, Nick Carter.
So, Arlene, underscoring how fraught the range of issues are, Richard was just talking about the political implications potentially for Acting Mayor Kim Janey. Is this fraught with all of these layers of issues? We're talking about domestic violence, we're talking about race, or is this as simple as, and this is not a rhetorical question, is this as simple as if the acting mayor does not feel the police commissioner is a fit, then the acting mayor can do something about that?
I think the answer to your question is yes and yes. You know, the statement by his lawyer sounds vaguely like something Clarence Thomas once said to during his nomination hearings. And it raises a question that I think in this context doesn't quite work. You know, when you're talking about domestic violence, I think we have to look at the entire system we're dealing with here. You know, I've heard, for example, some issues raised about Marty Walsh and the role that he played in this. And I'll add a personal comment here because I've known him for quite a long time and worked with him very closely in the legislature on marriage equality, on trans equality, on abortion rights and other progressive issues. And I can say that anyone who knows Marty Walsh well knows that he would never knowingly appoint as a police commissioner someone with a history of domestic violence accusations against them. So when you're dealing with someone who's the executive of an entity with thousands of employees, you don't expect them to be reading through hundreds of pages of documents about someone's past employment information. They count on their advisors to do it. So to me,
although Arlene, Dennis White has said that he told Mayor Walsh of the restraining order that his ex-wife had taken out against him.
There was one instance in which he claimed that Walsh should have known. He actually didn't say that my understanding is that he didn't say that he told him. But I will say this, when Gross said, you should appoint Dennis to replace me, at that point, it was the obligation and the responsibility of Willie Gross to say to him, and let me flag for you, in case you don't remember, of the thousands of employees who work for you, this is the guy who had accusations of domestic violence against him. It should have been flagged by Gross and by others of Walsh's, of his advisors. And by not doing that, and none of them have claimed they did it, by not doing that, I think they ill-served Walsh, and I think they failed the city as well. But in fairness to Gross, Dennis White rose through the ranks before him under Menino and under other police commissioners for decades. Well, apparently some people in the police department knew about these domestic violence allegations. So to me, what this raises is that there's something fundamentally wrong with the system there at the Boston Police Department.
Okay, a couple of clarifications. Go ahead, Richard. Go.
I think it's important to point out that he was promoted five times over the years and, you know, and to get to the level that he did, his record was reviewed. So it isn't, you know, and there was never any, and I'm not saying he's right or wrong, but you did have a messy divorce where you had, you know, each of them had a kid who came out and said that, you know, one of them was the abuser, the other one was the abuser. You had the wife's sister-in-law, wife's sister come out and stick up for him. So who knows what the truth is, but, you know, the point is 20 years ago, this wasn't resolved. And now, you know, this guy's life is basically been ruined because of, you know, in the city, I think the police department has really been affected by all the negative publicity that's come out as a result of it, too. So it hasn't been a fair process. It hasn't been handled well. And I think it gives everybody involved a black eye.
So I'm going to give a couple of points of clarification, then go to calls. First, when we say William Gross, we're talking about former Boston Police Commissioner. He said in an affidavit, he wrote, there is no way anyone is brought onto the command staff without such a briefing to the mayor and approval by the mayor, just to give listeners what Gross wrote. And when I talked about the reference to the restraining order, that was Dennis White himself who said that he had told Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, then Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, about the restraining order at one point. Just 2 points of fact there. I'm going to go grab a couple of calls. 800-423-8255 is the number. We have Julie Rowley. Julie, go ahead.
Hi. I was calling because you were talking about accountability, and the school committee people should definitely not be school committee members if they've shown any sort of racial bias, because they cannot do their job properly, and that's never going to be trained out of them. That's who they are. The same with bad cops who react violently to certain groups of people should never be cops. It just shouldn't be allowed. They should be fired. That's my comment.
Thanks for the call, Julie. Thank you for the call, Julie. And we've got a counterpoint, I think, to some extent, in Grant in Arlington. So, Grant, you are up.
Hi. Just looking at this, we're dealing with accusations, and over time, domestic violence obviously is an extreme, but an evolving set of standards, and no possibility, it seems, of growth or atonement that a person could have looked something in their youth or in their early adulthood or their past and say, that was a mistake, or move past it, and in some ways actually be stronger for the experience. So we don't seem to allow for anything. It becomes an absolute penalty, in some cases actually in here, based on an accusation. So that might be even more of a tenuous reason to levy that penalty.
So I'm going to take it back from you there, Grant. Thank you. And so we have Julie and Grant there in the if people do it, they can't be changed. And if it affects their ability to do the job, they have to go. And the other side being people change, people grow, and you have to leave room for that. And those point and counterpoint do seem to be at the heart of this. Arlene, very quickly, because I do want to go to a break, but I think I heard you wanting to say one more thing.
Well, I what to me was striking was Janie's comments about the fact that when Dennis White admitted at his hearing that he had, in fact, hit and pushed members of his household, that he showed no regret or no contrition. To me, that's the most important variable that we're dealing with. Had he said, you know what, I was young, I was stupid, I was wrong, I've never done it since, and I deeply regret it, I'd view it differently.
Still with us are Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, and Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Listeners, we are going to pivot to talk about Boston Pride, the second year in a row without an official Pride in June. Still, what should Pride look like in this year, and how can Boston Pride be more inclusive of Black and Brown and trans voices, voices that originally created the movement more than 50 years ago? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arlene, the board president of Boston Pride, Linda DeMarco, says that she'll resign this summer in response to ongoing pressure to diversify Pride's board and better recognize the needs and contributions of people of color and trans members of the LGBTQ community. Reactions to that decision, is it the right thing to do for DeMarco to step aside?
Well, it does sound like the Pride Committee made some mistakes, having absolutely no diversity on their board, having no Black members, the way they responded to BLM. They made mistakes. Candidly, we all do. They needed to be more diverse. Candidly, we all do. They needed to be more anti-racist, and we all do. So I don't think we have to negate all the good that they did in the past in order to say that they need to do better. And so hopefully these new activists with new energy and new focus will do an even better job going forward than has been in the past.
So, Richard, I'm going to play some sound for you from an activist from one of the newer groups. This is Chastity Bowick, who is the executive director of the Transgender Emergency Fund and the co-founder of Trans Resistance Massachusetts. Chastity, along with others, organized the Trans Resistance March and Vigil after George Floyd's death. Here is Chastity Bowick.
Trans Resistance came out of everything that happened last year. And then to have Boston Pride put out an insensitive statement, not recognizing what's going on within the Black community, and especially with the trans women of color. And so at this point, we had had enough, and we wanted our voices to be heard, and we want to be seen.
So there have been a number of critiques of the Pride movement, Richard, over the last several years, everything from failing to recognize the deep, deep threat to Black trans women in America, to whitewashing, to becoming too corporate. And I wonder both what you think of those critiques and when an organization that was born out of pushback and rebellion begins to go mainstream, for lack of a better word. What's the way to pull it back to its roots?
Well, I think you have a lot, obviously, going on. And as you said, there's been just tremendous success in so many different areas as far as, what's happened, with the community. I mean, you have same-sex marriage, legal adoption, gays in the military, employment protections, trans discrimination bill passed here in Massachusetts, and a lot of good things have happened. The parade itself has grown. I mean, this is a huge event with over 1 million people, but, how do you deal with success? And I guess, there are a lot of people who have concerns that there isn't enough activism taking place and that things have become too commercialized. And just to go back to what Arlene was saying, there were concerns that the board was, getting too stale and that they weren't bringing in, new people and making sure that the board was diverse and representative of the community as a whole. So you have a lot of things going on. Part of it, I think, too, is generational. You have younger progressives that that do things a different way and probably have some ideas that are different from some of the people who have traditionally been involved in this. And then I think you have a whole thing going on right now that gay pride has become, as much about race and gender as it is about sexual orientation, which it originally what was the organizing principle. So, you add all that up and you add in what happened with George Floyd, and that's still reverberating. And yet there's just a lot going on and you're seeing the transition into something, the next stage of the movement.
Listeners, what is or should be, hang on just a second, Arlene, what is or should be the next stage of the LGBTQ movement in Massachusetts, of Pride in Massachusetts? What's the vision today and what's the imperative? 1-800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Arlene, go ahead.
As an historic note to what I said a moment ago, my co-chair at the Mass Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus is a guy named Gary Daffin. He's been the co-chair with me for many years, since like the 1990s. We wanted Gary on our board and we wanted him to become our co-chair, not only because he was politically smart and thoughtful and a good writer with good political judgment, but bonus points, he was going to be the first Black guy heading a major LGBT organization back when we were larger, admittedly. And he's played an invaluable role ever since. But that has not been the history of most LGBTQ organizations in Massachusetts. There have not been very many until somewhat recently people of color heading those organizations. So it's important that our community moves forward along with the rest of our culture to try and deal with the systemic and structural racism that's been embedded in our organizations, maybe unintentionally, for years.
So let's stay with that for a minute. Here's Casey Dooley, the former chair of Boston Black Pride under Boston Pride. Casey broke away from the Boston Pride and joined the coalition of groups calling for accountability. She currently runs Boston Black Pride, which she reclaimed from the Boston Pride organization. And here's what she told WBUR.
The community members, really, from what I'm hearing, really want to reimagine what Pride looks like.
So what is the reimagining? If that's the call, and Arlene, I hear you talking about Richard, I hear you talking about what comes next. What is that reimagining? One of the questions is, what happens with the rest of the Boston Pride board? Should there be a massive turnover there? Does the governance have to change at some fundamental level in an organization for it to move to the next level, Richard?
Well, I think whatever happens, moving forward, the past is really good to look at and, how things were done. I mean, obviously, there was a pretty successful, organization built that put on a huge event. I think, we do have to celebrate diversity, but we have to remember moving forward that we need to be inclusive. And I just want to, and this is on this along the same lines, but, just mention what happened in New York, because it's the same type of thing that I think people worried about here, where the Heritage of Pride Committee banned gay police and law enforcement from marching in the parade, from banned gay officers from being able to participate. And we shouldn't, as a group, change any of the original principles that we all believe in, and that's inclusion and allowing people to participate. And I hope that moving forward, whatever the next iteration is of the parade and the people who are going to be running the organization, that they do things the same way, that they reach out, and build coalitions, and that they're not the type who are going to, cancel, boycott, and bully, that they end up doing the right thing. And I think that's going to be, a lot of people are going to be watching.
Let me grab a call here. Evan in Jamaica Plain. Evan, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think it's important that we acknowledge the real history here. This conversation largely, I think, has been divorced from the reality that the Pride movement was born out of an anti-police brutality movement. And I don't really want to be lectured by a Republican senator who has actively undermined the rights of my community about canceling or bullying or boycotting, when in fact, boycotting and protesting and militant resistance has been essential for the livelihoods and survival of trans and queer communities. And I don't think this is about the next phase of our movement. This is about reclaiming the roots of our movement, which has always been about opposing police violence and fighting for the most marginalized members of our community, who frankly are not being heard on this program. It's interesting that we're talking about inclusion and diversity in Boston Pride, and we don't have any Black trans women on this show to talk about it.
Well, so this is a week in review, and we actually have earlier in the week had one of our own reporters talk about it, and it's an issue that we've talked about with Black and trans voices in the past on the show, although I don't ever want to not take a critique, Evan, so point heard. However, Richard, I think Evan was critiquing you as well, so I do want to give you a chance to respond.
Well, I don't think I really need to. He doesn't know anything about me. I supported gay marriage. Eileen can speak to my record in the legislature. And I do think, again, this is sort of, it speaks to what I was saying, that everybody should be welcomed, and that we shouldn't be excluding people. And this is, a lot of people feel as though that the gay rights movement is being captured by really, I don't want to say radical progressives, but a group of progressives that are much more progressive than the people who have been running things for a while.
So, Richard,
it's generational, so it's, I think, it is a little different.
I do want to point out, you've run in multiple elections also as an openly gay candidate, and I'm not sure our caller knew that. As well.
No, we can get into that when we get to the Republicans.
Which we will do after the break.
Sure.
So Arlene, I do. And we are going to do that. We've got time reserved to do that. Before we run to a break, Arlene, I do want to give you a chance for voice here. I do want to note Evan saying we've got to get back to our roots, which was a response to police brutality. Richard calling out in New York a pride parade that didn't allow gay and LGBTQ officers to march. And so I want to bring a third voice in on that. I want to give you a chance.
Well, I've always viewed Pride as a very political event. I wasn't crazy how over the years it became more and more corporate in the layout. And Gary Daffin and I always used Pride to organize our community around legislative issues for the LGBTQ community. But the fact of the matter is, not everyone agreed with us. I emceed Pride in 1990, and I was a marshal 15 years later. I wanted Pride to be political, but not everyone shared that view. And so there's always been a tension between those of us who wanted it to be political and those of us who wanted it to be a party, those of us who wanted it to be about education for the public, and those of us who wanted it to be about assimilation and mainstreaming. I think that tension will always exist to a certain extent, and there's probably no one right answer that will suit everyone. So perhaps there's a hybrid model that we can come up with.
And I want to note as we go to break, Evan called back to correct me. Evan's pronouns are she and her. I always appreciate that correction. Thank you, Evan. And I'm glad to have an opportunity to get that right. With us this hour, Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, and Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a congressional candidate in 2012 and 2014. Listeners, before the break, we were talking about the resignation or the pending resignation of the president of the Board of Boston Pride. We are now going to follow that thread through and begin talking about a rift in the Republican Party in Massachusetts that's been most exposed of late after comments about a gay congressional candidate. If you're a Republican, we want to hear from you. Is the party splitting down the middle along Trump and Baker lines? What's at the core of the fight over a gay married congressional candidate in the state party? What's going on and what needs to happen next in your mind? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I also want to note that it's Pride Month, and later in the month, Radio Boston will be doing a full hour on policy issues, history, and more on the LGBTQ community in the Commonwealth. So watch for that in the days to come. Let's begin here with Jeffrey Sosa-Peckett, the congressional candidate, and comments by Deborah Martell, a member of the state Republican committee, that were homophobic. The melee that has ensued with elected Republicans calling on her to resign, her refusal to resign, Jim Lyons, the state party chair's refusal to ask her to resign. Arlene, I'm actually going to start with you on this. Should Martell resign?
Well, normally I'm a big supporter of free speech and people's rights to say what they will, and I'm used to dealing with people who are homophobic and trying to persuade them otherwise. It's a little different in the case of Deborah Martell because of the many emails apparently she sent out to people decrying the sickness of this gay couple who had children, who dared to have children. Besides calling them immoral, she actually said apparently that, quote, we don't have any room in the party for such things. So the minute she said that, she crossed the line. When she started saying that we don't have room, you can't be in the Republican Party if you're a gay, married couple with kids, well then, honey, we can say the same thing about you.
So Richard, picking up on Arlene's point, there's no room in the party. You ran as an openly gay candidate multiple times here in the last decade or so. How do you feel when you hear a member of the Republican State Committee say that?
You know what, my personal experience has been pretty good, and running within the Republican Party, I really didn't have any problems. You hear comments like that every now and again, and you just brush them off and move forward. But I think that it's kind of funny. Once I saw that Arlene was going to be on the show, I was thinking back, and the first time I ever met her, she was standing in front of the House chamber, I think it was in the late 80s, and she was buttonholing the representatives as they were walking into the chamber to get them to vote to override Governor Dukakis's veto of a bill that would allow for gay adoptions in Massachusetts. And I kind of think, through from that point on to now, just how far we've come. I mean, we have made I know younger people get frustrated, but we've made like incredible progress. And, we're at the point where here within the Republican Party, everybody, is pretty
impressed that everybody came out and pretty much, stood up and said that this isn't what we want in our party, whether it was the governor, the lieutenant governor, the all of the legislators, I think, but one, ended up signing a letter, rebuking her. And I do think that, I know it's, you hate to see it, the issue, in and of itself, and you hate to see prejudice out there like that and bigotry, but, the fact of the matter is that the leaders of the party stood up for what was right. And as far as her resigning, she was elected. The way to get her out is to find somebody to run, and everybody should support that candidate. The person who should resign, though, is really Jim Lyons, because he is the chairman of the party. And when this happened, it was a great opportunity for him to lead and to say, as the chairman of the party, he's supposed to make sure that, that everybody is welcomed within the party. And he missed a golden opportunity to do that. And that's just because of his actions and things that are happening right now. Things are really spiraling out of control, and I think he's the one, if somebody should resign, it should have been him.
So I want to put the number out to listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If this is a story you're following, do you believe that the state Republican Committee Chair Jim Lyons should resign? Do you believe, as Richard says, do you agree that you feel that the state has moved forward dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years? And if so, where do you want to see the state move next on LGBTQ rights, on public policy, on presence in elected office? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arlene, let's pick up on the question of Jim Lyons. And I'm going to play, we've got this remarkable moment where it essentially appears that Jim Lyons, the chair, and Tom Mountain, the vice chair, basically aren't speaking to each other right now. Here's Vice Chair Tom Mountain speaking to WBUR.
What she did was heinous. It was intolerant. And quite frankly, it makes the rest of the party look bad. And the chairman initially stayed out of it, and then he doubled down to back her.
Now, you made a reference to free speech earlier. Lyons has been arguing that this is about free speech and about deeply held religious belief. Here's Jeffrey Sosa Paquette, the congressional candidate, speaking to NBC Boston on the issue.
We're all entitled to our free speech. What we're not entitled to is to take those free speech and then weaponize it to seek harm.
Now, Arlene, you've already signaled that you agree with Sosa Paquette, but let's talk about the place of speech in a community as it figures out its platform and in leadership of an institution or an organization, even if that is volunteer or appointed leadership. How do we comb that out?
There's a couple of things worth, I think, throwing into the mix here. Firstly, about the Jim Lyons piece. For those of us who have lobbied LGBTQ issues and choice issues in the last many years, particularly the years when Jim Lyons was a state legislator, we all know how he led the charge against us on every single LGBTQ and abortion-related issue that came up. So none of us are surprised by the passivity he is showing when it comes to someone else saying egregiously anti-gay things. What I find particularly instructive, and I've been listening to the comments of Tom Mountain and others who worry that Jim Lyons and Deborah Martel's comments reinforce the worst images of Republicans as sort of, I heard the phrase, cultural wackadoodles used by one of them. So I was reading in the Globe a story where one of the Globe reporters was interviewing Republicans to see what they thought about it. And candidly, I have to admit, I thought some of them were pretty funny. They had one guy, Dave from Hingham, who apparently said that he thought Republicans need to move in a direction that reflects their constituents and not their dead relatives. So, there is a sense, apparently, that Jim is passé composé and that the Republican Party has to move forward in the future in a very different fashion.
And can I just say, too, it's kind of interesting that we're talking about this on the state level, because nationally, the party, and I can attest to this, I'm involved with the Log Cabin Republicans on the national level. The party has become much more tolerant, much more inclusive, and it isn't the same type of, struggle that we were having, a few years back. The party's really made a lot of progress. on things. So, you know, and it's funny, too, because if you look at the New York Times exit votes for the 2020 election, the gay support for the Republican presidential candidate doubled over the last 4 years between, you know, what Trump got and the first time and the second time. So I think, you know, that that this sort of is a, in Massachusetts, is a step backwards. And, you know, we need to be a party that supports individual rights and, you know, and liberty and making sure that everybody's treated equally and fairly under the law.
So this gives us. Go ahead, Arlene, and then I'm going to transition us. Go ahead.
So many people are calling on different people to resign. The Salem News editorialized a great line. They said, keeping track of who is calling on whom to resign is almost a full-time job. So within the Republican ranks, everyone is pointing fingers at each other and demanding that the other person resign.
So this is an interesting thing. It's going to take us into the larger struggle for the party now. So we've been talking about the particular anti-gay comments by a particular member of the state committee, referring to the candidacy of Jeffrey Sosa Paquette. I want to now talk about the fight that is ensuing, and that really had started before that, for control of the state Republican Party. And Richard, you brought in the question of sort of the Trump wing of the party versus the more moderate wing of the party. So I want to start with a little bit of sound here. Here's state GOP committeeman Steve Aylward, and then we're going to hear Republican Arete Pascucci speaking to NBC 10's Allison King.
Maybe we're better off without the governorship, and we're able to grow the party from the ground up.
Our Republican Party's in shambles right now. It's beyond talking about. He's the number one governor in the country, and he's a Republican. Why wouldn't we be standing behind our governor?
And so we know that there's been a rift between Jim Lyons and Republican Governor Charlie Baker, even an attempt to remove elected Republicans from, allow the executive committee of the state party to remove elected Republicans from voting. I want to add here former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, a Republican, speaking from WBUR's Anthony Brooks.
It is shocking to me that a party that is almost irrelevant, that has an asset like Charlie Baker, would be almost at war with the most important attribute that they have. They should be courting Charlie Baker. They should send him flowers. They should see how he likes his coffee and make sure that they hand deliver it to him.
So strong comments there, Arlene. Can a state party walk away from its elected representatives and remain viable?
I think that a party which wants to be taken seriously in this day and age has to speak truth. And they have to be willing, at a bare bones minimum, to condemn egregious hatred and bigotry when it comes out in such an obvious and crass fashion as Deborah Martel did. If they're not willing to say even that, then they're just endorsing the Trumpian tactics, being crass and unapologetic about it.
And Richard, it does seem that this mirrors a larger struggle in the party across the country versus more moderate Republicans and those who want to double down either directly on Donald Trump or the messages of Donald Trump. I mean, the state party replaced the picture of Charlie Baker on its website with a picture of Donald Trump in 2020. Are we seeing a struggle play out here in the Commonwealth that is part of a larger national struggle? And how do we think about that?
Well, I think in Massachusetts, it's a little different. I think there's, you know, if you look historically, as long as I've been involved, at least since the early 80s, here it's more social conservative versus moderate centrist Republicans. And you've had, you know, the people who have got elected, Bill Weld, Paul Cellucci, Charlie Baker, you know, really fit into that moderate, mold. And I think for the people in Massachusetts, it's really important that you have somebody like Charlie Baker and Karen Polito in office, you know, that can provide a check and balance. And it's really important to have a two-party system for a whole bunch of reasons. So Jane Swift is right. I mean, we're very lucky to have Charlie Baker. He's not You know, I don't agree with them on every issue, and but you know, thank God we have him, and we should be, you know, we should be working really closely with him to, you know, to rebuild the party and do what we can. You know, and as the chairman of the party, the chairman really should, you know, if there is a Trump group and there is a Baker group, the chairman's job is to bring everybody together, not to divide them. And that's why I'm saying we really need to get a chairman in place who can bring all the different groups together and say, you know, here's the goal, and get people all rowing in the same direction.
All right, Richard and Arlene, I wish we had like 5 hours for everything we've been talking about today. There's so much here, but this is a one-hour show, and I do want to leave a little bit of time for hubbubs, which are those little local stories that caught our attention this week, so I'm going to shift us now. Arlene, did you bring us a hubbub?
I did indeed. The between the controversy around Boston Pride and also the challenges of the pandemic, which has been upending plans for all sorts of parades, there does in fact remain Pride actions that and activities that are taking place in towns across the state this year. I attended a wonderful event at Melrose Pride in 2019 that many folks outside of Melrose may not have known about. This year, the town of Scituate will be holding its first ever Pride event. Now, it's not just for Scituate, it's for Scituate and surrounding communities. And they have planned a Pride Week filled with different activities, culminating in a Pride March on June 26th. So if folks who don't want to normally come to Boston in a normal year even went to scituatepride.com, they can learn about it. And on that, I wish everyone a happy and a healthy Pride Month.
Richard, how about you?
Well, just when you thought it was safe to go back outside with the after the pandemic, or in this case, you know, safe to go into the water, I noticed yesterday the state of Massachusetts just sent out a warning about dangerous marine animals in the water at Carlson Beach in Boston, Nahant Beach in Nahant, and Williston Beach in Quincy. So if you're out there this weekend, you might want to take a look for the lion's mane jellyfish. Most of us are on the lookout anyways when we go into the beach for jellyfish, but these are big ones, 120 feet long, 8 feet wide. And for some reason last year, there were more of them than usual, and I guess that's the case for this year as well. So if anybody's ever been stung by one, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So have a great weekend outdoors, but be careful if you're going.
And on that note, that's right. And also, Arlene, I just want to point out also the 2021 March and Vigil for Black Trans Lives will happen this weekend. It begins at 11 a.m. At Nubian Square. All right, folks, Richard Tessay, Arlene Isaacson, thank you so much for joining us today for Week in Review.
Very good.
Thank you. Happy Pride.
And listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.